Hello and welcome to Eggpod Express with me, Chris Shaw. Eggpod Express takes a jaunty stroll through 1960s music magazines with a potpourri of delicious guests. To read along with us, the magazine's online at iamtheeggpod.com, where you'll also find an exclusive playlist related to this particular issue. To support this podcast and to access bonus content, please subscribe to patreon.com/eggpod. And this is part two of my interview with Pete Perfides. Enjoy.
Oh, she may be weary. But young girls, they do get weary. Wearing that same old shaggy dress. Yeah. But when she gets weary, try a little tenderness.
Page 7.
The Stax Controversy.
Norman Jopling.
So this is like this, there's uproar among Record Mirror readers because the Record Mirror correspondent Norman Jopling, who's been at the paper for quite a while now, since 1961, has apparently written quite a scathing review of the Stax tour, which has arrived in the UK. And so there's quite a lot of angry letters. They sort of print extracts from all these kind of angry letters. People who sort of... And then they ask Norman Jopling for a right of reply, who sort of tries to defend his criticism. So he says, "My criticism of the show is directed primarily at Otis Redding, not only towards his performance, but also the fact that he had billing out of all proportion to his status compared with the other artists on the bill." What are your thoughts, Chris?
I think also it's about filling copy as well, because the original feature or the original column by Norman was then followed up by, I think it's about a quarter page or a half page of editorial with a response by Frank Fenter, who was a label manager for Europe Atlantic Records, and he wasn't happy.
Right.
And now in this issue, we've got all the readers' letters. But I think it's the fact they've taken three issues of this, I think they're just trying to court controversy. Because they describe, before they talk about his response, they say, "Now here's the last word from demon critic Norman Jopling." And I think they're just going to drum up some kind of Twitter pile on.
It's a little bit like what the BBC Sport are doing at the moment with their new signing, Wayne Rooney, who they're really trying to kind of push forward as the kind of outspoken voice of football criticism. But unfortunately, Wayne Rooney sort of can't string seven words together to save his life. And they've really put all this kind of weight of expectation upon him. They've given him a show, and, you know, he appears on Match of the Day. You know, Match of the Day is, I know it's really a bit of a detail, but Match of the Day, you know, when you're sort of being a pundit and you've got to sort of talk concurrently with the kind of replayed highlights where you're trying to sort of explain some kind of tactical failing or tactical, you know, excellence from the team you've just seen. It's a bit of a skill to explain what's happening while it's happening. Mm-hmm. And Paul Wayne just can't sort of recall the words. So they've kind of, it reminds us, this is a bit of an age-old thing, to get an outspoken voice to sort of say their piece and then get the reaction, get their reaction to the reaction. So I get they're quite ahead of their time in a way, Record Mirror, in getting Norman Jopling to do this stuff.
Yes.
But I sort of think, you know, I've heard these recordings, I don't know what it's like to be there in person, but literally I would say, I'm trying not to exaggerate, but I would say that one of my three favourite live recordings of a single song of all time, and I'm going to, if you don't have it, Chris, I'm going to send it to you so we can drop it in, because I will absolutely stand by this, is the live version of Shake, which was released as a single from this tour. And it's fucking unbelievable.
Shake! Everybody say it. Shake! Early in the morning. Late in the evening. In the midnight hour. When the time going bad now. Shake with the feeling. Shake with the feeling.
the levels are kind of all wrong in a way. It's like you wouldn't, like, if you're trying to record music quote unquote properly, you wouldn't have it like overloading, you know, the needle's in the red the whole time, and you can sort of, you can practically hear the drum riser sort of shaking with the power of the way the drummer's sort of hitting the drums. It's just incredible. Everything, the horns are just sort of like slightly distorting, but it's just this completely sensory overload. And so it is surprising to me that Norman Jopley is sort of singles out Otis Redding as a sort of, you know, okay, maybe he was too high on the bill, but I think if anyone watching would sort of think he deserved it. And now we sort of like, if we think about who was on that bill, so what, we got sort of Sam and Dave, who else have we, Arthur Connolly, yeah. Booker T and the MGs. I don't think you would, Eddie Floyd, you know. Hindsight tells us that Otis Redding was probably, certainly with hindsight, he's a good headliner.
Absolutely. Well, I think Frank Fenton said that the fact that Booker T were on first was purely because they were an instrumental band. He said you can't have singers on and then follow that with
an instrument. Yeah, and also I think they might be, at least some of them might be the backing band for the artists that are following. So yes, it kind of makes sense for them to be bedded in.
And, yeah.
Yeah, you're right.
Trouble and death in the Middle East. A ground and air battle heavily damages Tiberias on the Israeli-Syrian border. Israeli Premier Levi Eshkol inspects the ruins. This farming settlement, or kibbutzim, lies in an area claimed by both nations. The fighting erupted quickly when Syrians allegedly fired on Israeli farmers operating tractors. Israel used tanks, mortars, and aircraft to counterattack. Syrian officials claimed 70 Israelis killed on the ground and 5 warplanes shot down. Israel claimed 6 Syrian MiGs. Premier Eshkol said friendly foreign powers will understand the situation.
We've got a new album's review by Norman Joplin and Peter Jones.
Norman Joplin, he's back on this page reviewing albums. He eventually joined CBS Records. Did you know this?
No.
And he moved to New York. He became a songwriter.
Wow.
So, yeah, talking of stacks, there's a review of Eddie Floyd's Knock on Wood album, which is adjudged an unfortunate choice of material on account of the fact that most of the songs have been sung by other artists.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Do we care? Yeah. Do people care about things like that in 1967?
I don't think so.
No.
I mean, look at, Motown were doing the same thing. Stax were doing the same
thing. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Otis Redding's got a new album out as well, Talking of Stax. It's called, I guess they're probably timing the release of these albums.
With a tour, yeah.
With the tour.
Going back to Eddie Floyd, there's one, aside from the title track, there's a song I really like, but it's All Right.
Right.
Which predates, it sounds like an early version of Steppenwolf's Magic Carpet Ride.
Wow.
One of the highlights for me, that. I love this album. Yeah, Otis Redding as well. Yeah, it's got to be, or the tour has been done.
Yeah,
to combine with these albums.
Yeah, Otis's album gets a good review.
The main album review is Elvis's, which is a huge part of the page.
Yeah,
remarkable sincerity on L's "How Great Thou Art" album.
I don't know that. Do you know this record,
Chris? No.
Crying in the Chapel is on it.
Yeah, that's the main one. But I think that's obviously gospel songs. I've heard a few from it, but. It's not really 1967 as we recall it, I think.
No, no.
Wonderful Eggpod Express.
You've also got the Dennis Walton Orchestra, Swinging Folk.
Oh, wow.
Which are swing versions of old English folk songs.
Like, I think I'd quite enjoy that, actually.
Yeah. London Bridge is Falling Down, Fill the Fluter's Ball.
I think I need to have this record. I mean, I do, you know, like, well, you know, it's probably not quite Pentangle, but, you know, Pentangle certainly brought up their own kind of swing to a lot of traditional arrangements. I'd be up for that.
Got the Alexandra Brothers with Sing Country Hits, more country music, which they go through some popular country and western items in the inimitable and appealing style. And they're a Scottish duo who had a minor hit in 1964 with a cover of Nobody's Child, wow, which they claim sold more than the Beatles in Scotland.
That's a very specific claim, isn't it? Yeah, and there's a big advert for which says, Dear Am is different. We've got Cat Stevens again with I'm Gonna Get Me a Gun. And The Move with I Can Hear the Grass Grow.
Banger. Page 9,
right, yeah.
New singles reviewed by Peter Jones.
There's lots of interesting things out in this week's singles. The headlines, well, the sort of the stamper says, top 50 tips include a clever Yardbirds and a charming new Jimmy Ruffin. There's a powerful new Lulu on a new label and a version of Dylan's It Ain't Me, Babe, which we've already discussed, from Davy Jones, oldie. Yeah, and also, yeah, good reviews for... So Jackie Edwards gets a good review, who obviously best known for Keep On Running. And The Herd, who I'm actually quite obsessed with, I've got to say.
Close at midnight phantom, walk across my blind, play upon my mind till the dark is over. Shackled in prison, longing for your touch, needed oh so much to release my wings, so that I can fly.
The Herd with I Can Fly and Diary of a Narcissist. Songs specially tailored for the group by the Howard Blakely team, again, Dave D, Dozy Beak and Mika Titch. And this robust treatment, with plenty of interest all the way, could easily make the charts. I'm obsessed with The Herd, mainly because I'm obsessed with Andy Bowne from The Herd, because he is such a bewilderingly frequent presence on the cover of magazines in the 60s. He's a little bit like the equivalent of John Taylor from Duran Duran in the 80s, as, you know, a non-lead singer who is, by unspoken consensus, decreed to be the hottest member of the band. And so he's the one that kind of... So if you kind of on magazines like Top Pops or Disco Music Echo, he really sort of punches above his weight, sort of pictorial. Yeah, and obviously The Herd sort of eventually go their separate ways. And then he resurfaces at some point as a sort of uncredited member of Status Quo.
Right.
And for a long, long time, he's an uncredited member of Status Quo. And then when, you know, sometime, I think slightly before Rick Parfitt dies, he's sort of finally kind of assimilated into the official lineup, starts appearing in the photos. And I sort of think... It's quite interesting, you know, what is Andy Bowne's ego like? Probably quite healthy, really, because
yes,
he clearly didn't mind that, you know, he was a heartthrob. He was like a really good-looking man, like a little bit of a mod icon back in the day. And then you know, so he's kind of quite happy to just sort of suddenly, like, in this ensuing decade, he's probably sort of thinking, well, I probably just need a regular sort of gig, really, yeah. You know, yeah, I'll just be lurking in the shadows of Status Quo, and has stayed there for several decades,
yeah,
and he's just sort of there. So I kind of latterly I've been kind of googling his name for you and trying to find out more about him, looking at YouTube interviews with Andy. It turns out he's like quite a waspish kind of Charlie Wattsy kind of guy, sort of very smart, kind of dry sense of humour. And he's just one of these people who's just happy to kind of watch from the shadows. Not a prolific songwriter by any means. He's a guy who just clocks in, does his thing, And it probably has probably be great to be sitting next to on an aeroplane. He sort of implies on several occasions that he's seen a few things. And and I really like it. I think he's a kind of like, I think I sort of slightly aspire to be a little bit like Andy Bowen, in as much as just someone who is just kind of putting in the hours and just sort of, not everything you do has to be sort of glamorous or kind of, it's just like, he clearly has other things going on in his life that make him happy. And so, you know, I'm now keeping a very regular interest in the exploits of Andy Bowen.
Be more like Andy Bowen.
I think so. I think we all need to be more like Andy Bowen. Well, not all of us, because we need stars. We need people who actually want to be stars. But I like the fact that Andy Bowen's seen enough of it to not really want to be one.
I still love the line, I've seen some things.
You should. I do exhort anyone listening to go do have a little bit of a kind of poodle around the internet and to watch Andy Bowen talking. He has a very sort of careworn wisdom about him.
Granny Takes a Trip. Do you know, I think maybe I went there once later on, but I was a bit scared of Granny Takes a Trip. I know Ronnie Wood used to go there when he was in the Byrds. And I know they had some weird clothes. But I was more sort of the other end of King's Road, the Peter Jones end. But, you know, I still had sort of suede boots and satin shirts with frilly bits and all that. Disgusting, really.
We got the Bee Gees as well, haven't we? New York Mining Disaster, which remembered from before, likely to be very big, Beatles sounding as well. That's what they how they describe it.
Oh, very much so. So page 10, yeah, we're back to Big L, an expanded playlist. It's Tony Hall's Tips with the Top and what's big on Radio London at the moment. And again, at this point, the government is doing everything in its power to get rid of pirate radios, so it's a dying art. But there's more DRAM success. And they were having a really good time. They got Ivers Kaiser, Bills, Batman, Whistling Jack Smith, Cat Stevens and Denny Lane. At the bottom, there's just three lines long. One final word about DRAM, Big David Bowie. Singer, songwriter, arranger, producer, social commentator, general all-round talent. Very Tony Newlish, his first LP as a guest. Tiny in the middle of the magazine, yeah. Isn't it? Three
the other
lines.
Thing that caught my attention is it's a mention of Denny Cordell, who was, you know, massively in demand as an independent producer working for DRAM alongside Mike Hurst, which I think so. Denny's latest creation features former Moody Blues lead singer Denny Lane. This really is a work of love called Say You Don't Mind. The backing's by a string quartet. I mean, Denny Lane's a little bit like Andy Bowen as well, isn't he? He's just one of the people, he sort of had a few moments in the spotlight. And when, you know, the Wings job came along, he was like, okay, I'm good with this, you know. Which is a like.
He certainly saw some things.
Yes. So this is really interesting. So Tony Hall says it's a nice record. Cordell's next challenge, to produce a hit with Beverly. Paul Simon told me he thinks she's a tremendous talent. She recorded again last Wednesday week. Now, Beverly is, at this point, her surname is not referred to. She's Beverly Cutner, who later will fall in love with John Martin and become Beverly Martin and record with him. And John Martin somewhat infamously sort of hijacked her solo deal, and as a result of which they recorded those John and Beverly Martin albums. And, you know, he, as we know, he wasn't a great husband, and she was pregnant and effectively, you know, sort of was consigned to sort of stay at home whilst John Martin, you know, used those two albums as a launch pad for his own.
I annoyed John Martin.
Did you? How?
Years ago, I was in a band, and there was an open air show. I think it was Castlebury Park in Watford, if wow. memory serves me well. And we were obviously low down on the bill, and I think he was headlining, or one of the headliners. And he was doing his sound check, and we were literally due on in about half an hour, but he was jamming, and we hadn't had a chance to do a sound check. So he started taking the piss out of his songs and running around and jumping up in front of him, maybe doing, waving with our fists in a jaunty manner at him. And he literally used the line, "Don't you know who I am?" And we were cheered.
Brilliant. Did he have both of his legs at this point?
I certainly didn't.
Because, you know, because he couldn't chase after you if he didn't, obviously. No. Amazing. Wow. Well,
I'm not proud of it, Pete. I'm just saying.
Know, it's just, you know. Also, I'm quite excited here to see Tony Hall mentions that it was his birthday party recently, and he's a little bit late. He had a bit of an excellent time at Paddy Fleming's birthday party. He works for Philips. So he's only just started catching up on some other releases, such as Dusty Springfield's I'll Try Anything, which he likes. But also, in the same package that he received that, came The Four Seasons Begging, which also very successfully covered by Time Box. And this is a first-rate record, and he's not wrong, is he?
Absolutely.
Just behind the big flower pots was a little weed. She knocked gently on the two big flower pots and said, "Weed! Weed!" And slowly, out of the flower pots came the flower pot men. First, out came their little faces, smiling all over. Then their little hands with big garden gloves on. They both turned round and saw each other.
Ooh, whoa.
Then they said hello to the little weed in their flower pot way of talking.
Oh, hello, little weed. Hello, hello, hello.
And the little weed laughed and said, "Weed! Weed!" And the flower pot men thought she meant that someone was coming. So they popped down into their flower pots again.
I gave her everything she wanted, just to keep her by my side. But she wasn't satisfied. Oh no, I feel so good if she really
This is great. There's a thing alongside it, a picture-led column called Names and Faces by Peter Jones. And so this is really sort of publicity shots, isn't it, of artists, some already known, some brand new. And there's a really wonderful photograph of a 17-year-old Terry Reid, who is already apparently being hailed as an unusually strong pop talent. He now sings with Peter Jay's Jaywalkers, but made his public debut at the age of 5, singing at a dance celebrating the coronation. He plays guitar well. It only took up so much of his time that he left school midway through GCSE studies, and in no time was out on a tour with Paul Jones along with the Jaywalkers. So yeah, now recording with Columbia, and he's very dandy looking Terry Reid,
yes.
With a sort of neck a suit and frilly sleeves and a sort of necktie, with sort of reclining on a park bench with the four members of the Jaywalkers peeping up over behind the park bench.
Think Jacob Rees-Mogg in the House of Commons.
Oh yes, you're right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, so it's interesting, and obviously there was the whole thing about him being asked to join an early version of Led Zeppelin.
Deep Purple as well, apparently, Richie Blackmore.
Right, okay, yeah. I had one of my least satisfying interview experiences with Terry Reid many years later when his PR got in touch. Well, this was when I was working for The Times, and his PR got in touch with me and asked me if I'd be... He was coming into the country from Los Angeles, where he lived, to do some dates, which he was trying to... Well, tickets weren't selling very well, so his publicist, and I think his promoter, was trying to drum up some attention for those dates. And he said, do you think you could maybe get something into the Times? Which I sort of said, yeah, I think I can persuade my editor to sort of let me do something. So I arranged to meet him in an airport near Heathrow just after he sort of landed. And the interview went well. I thought we got on very well. I'm quite conscious of not really dwelling on things that have been mentioned too many times. So, you know, we had to glancingly allude to the Led Zeppelin thing, but I always try and word things in a slightly different way. And, you know, if I can get those quotes from secondary sources without hassling the person I'm interviewing, then I sort of rather do that. But you still have to mention it in the piece, you know, because it's the Times. Most Times readers probably won't know who Terry Reid is. Anyway, the tour came and went. He came back a year later, same problem. Promoter said, any chance you can... I said, well, I can't really interview him again, but we have a podcast that we do, so I can interview him for the podcast. And I sort of turned up. And the moment that we got into the studio, the red light came on. He suddenly became very angry. He said, can we just not... I can't remember exactly what he said. Can't we sort of go back over things that happened, you know, like 50 years ago? You know, it's just... I'm fucking bored of all that stuff, you know, like, you know... So if you can avoid all that stuff that you filled up with your previous sort of piece with. And a very sour, like in a very sour, ungrateful way. I'm not expecting gratitude, but also it's the reason, because he hadn't made an album for like 20 years or something, there was nothing new to sort
that
of
That is the
say.
Story then, isn't it?
How are you going to justify having him in the Times? And I just felt like my blood sort of went cold. I just felt like, just because of the kind of rancor in his eyes. And I just sort of like, I almost wanted to cry. And I was like, I held it together. I did like the bare minimum, 25 minutes. And I just sort of curtly said my thank yous and walked off. And I just thought, well, that's kind of, I can't help you, you know. I think it's just one of those things. He's probably like, you know, if it really bothered him that much, you know, that he was seen... I mean, say, by and large in his life, I think he could sort of forget all of that stuff because, you know, he lived, you know, he was friends with people like Joe Walsh and he'd often kind of jam with them on stage in LA where he lived. You know? And so I think, you know, he was a bit of a musician's musician. So when musicians are together on stage, none of that stuff matters. None of like what you're remembered for, what you're not remembered for, that you're just musicians in the moment. But that doesn't really work if you're a sort of journalist, you know, who's trying to justify to their editors why they should be in the sort of paper. But, you know, it's fine. You know, I only sort of mention it really because it's kind of a mildly interesting story. You know, I still listen to his music. Walk up.
There's one little piece on the left-hand column, and it's sort of hidden away. It says, he writes, one thing particularly interests me about the Monkees' new single. The whole thing has so much of Neil Diamond on it.
Oh, yeah.
A little bit me, a little bit you. Reminds me very much of Cherry Cherry and You Got To Me. Neither happened here. If only the kids who buy the Monkees in such quantities would do the same thing with Neil. He's such a talent, but I think he'll have to come here for TV before he finally breaks through. Still, brilliant. At least he's making money through these songs. So Neil Diamond, you know, he's nothing at this point in the UK.
Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it? There's a mention later on the gossip page as well as of about the similarity between whoever writes the sort of gossip thing at the back, says that the similarity between Little Be Me, Little Be You, Cherry Cherry is laughable.
Yeah.
I'm not impressed.
I know I stand in line until you think you have the time to spend an evening with me. And if we go someplace to dance, I know that there's a chance you won't be leaving with me. Then afterwards we drop into a quiet little place and have a drink or two. And then I go and spoil it all by saying something stupid like I love you.
So page 11, we have the Record Mirror charts page, which covers Britain's top 50 singles, top 30 LPs, top 10 EPs, as well as the top 20 R&B singles and the top 10 R&B albums, and the top 20 singles from 5 years ago, which is quite interesting as well. Also, airmailed from New York, the Cashbox top 50 singles. Mm. So at number one in the singles chart, we've got Frank and Nancy with Something Stupid.
Yeah.
And number one in the album charts, we've got the Sound of Music soundtrack. Surprise,
which was number
surprise.
One like forever, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was immovable.
I think the thing on the albums chart I noticed is basically the album chart is waiting for Sgt. Pepper to be released.
You're right, yeah.
You got Val Dunican, Burt Campfoot, Mantovani, Jim Reeves.
I mean, you really realise what the demographic sort of makeup it is. You know, it's changing though, because I think at this point, I read somewhere that in 1967, the average age of a UK citizen was 27.
Wow.
So, you know, people, you know, obviously because of the war, you know,
yes.
people were, the average age was very young, and that kind of reflected, you know, what was happening, you know, the kind of progressive positivity in society at the time. And I think the average age of the UK citizen now is some 60-something. Or I might have misremembered that, but it does sort of explain a lot of things that were happening then and are happening now.
Yes.
But there's some amazing records in the charts, and actually quite a lot of not amazing records in the charts. But that reference earlier on to The Shadows, just not really kind of from that correspondent on the letters page. You know, the Maroc 7 has gone in at 41, and it will go, eventually it will go up to number 24, but that's still their joint lowest chart position to date. And it will be 8 years before they have another hit, and that's their Eurovision entry, Let Me Be the One. This is a bit of a moment, really, here. So the Beatles have just dropped out of the top 10. They're number 12 with Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields Forever. One place above them, he's gone up 11 places to number 11, is Jimi Hendrix with Purple Haze. And this is a real moment, isn't it? Because he's sort of very much a presence in London right now. And in a couple of months' time, Sgt. Pepper will come out. And, you know, Jimmy opens his London show 3 days after the album's release with his own version of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Fan. Paul's in the audience. So what a time, you know, the history is being made in a very significant way on a sort of weekly basis, right?
I think so. And what you can see through, I mean, the singles charts, obviously you've got things like Arnold Lane in there as well.
Up 5 places to 26, right?
Yeah, On a Carousel. You know, there's some great singles in here, and it was a great year for singles. But I think if you compare that with the albums chart, it's basically Sound of Music and compilations and the Monkees. Even the Stones, they're only at number 9 with one of my favourite Stones albums, Between the Buttons. I genuinely love that album.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think kids are spending more money, well, they've only got a certain finite amount of money they're spending on singles.
Yeah.
Once Pepper's done, then people actually start investing on albums. Because I think the highest, we've got Best of the Beach Boys thrown together, Four Tops Live, but in terms of rock, there's the Stones at 9. There's nothing really.
It's amazing.
Else there in the albums chart.
No, and there's like real sort of, you know, the seeds of really interesting things. I mean, I didn't know that Prince Buster had an actual hit with Al Capone.
Yes.
and it's just gone down four places to number 22. So it's a top 20 hit. And so you can really sort of see, you know, what a formative thing it would have been. You know, obviously the influence it would have had, you know, he was such a huge influence on Madness and the Specials. Some of their earliest memories or their older siblings. I know certainly Terry Hall, who, when I interviewed him, he told me his older sister was a skinhead, and she was buying those records. She was one of the original sort of ska-loving skinheads. And so, these were hugely influential sort of songs that were also... And you're right, you know, it gives the top 50 singles a very different flavour. Arnold Lane, I mean, going up to number five places to 26. We're still going on about it, you know, after all these years. It's incredible.
Thank you. Tonight, leisure. Leisure is mowing the lawn and having no time to sit on it. Leisure is getting away from it all in a traffic jam. Leisure is a common pastime and a bus shelter pastime and a haystack pastime. Leisure spelt backwards is Eruziel. Think about it, it'll pass the time. To the comedian, it's a time to play golf. To the professional golfer, it's a time to stand at the bar telling funny stories. Leisure is Julian Amory. It's it's Edward Heath playing the organ and Sandy McPherson wishing he was leader of the opposition.
And now, brothers and sisters, from Indiana, USA, Britain's own soul brother, the one...
It's one in the album's charts, just because people will have heard of most of the other one. I absolutely love it's Gino Washington and the Ram Jam Band.
Right.
Hand clapping, foot stomping, funky butt live.
I don't know it.
Oh, man.
Really?
Since we finished this play.
Where, how to get into, obviously because of Gino by Dexys.
Right, well, this was released in 66. We're in April 67 now.
Yeah.
It stayed in the top 10 for 3 months. And at the time... And it was still in the top 40 in July, and it's basically a live album. The first side is pretty well one long medley, going through all these covers. And at the time, it was Pye's biggest selling album.
Thank you very much. We're going to do a little thing right now by Wilson Pickett. A little thing entitled One, Two, Three.
Obviously, Kevin Rowland wrote Gino as a tribute to Gino Washington. And I thought that Gino, because they do that on the album.
Oh, wow.
It's from there, but it's not. Apparently, it's from a Van Morrison album. It's Too Late to Stop Now. And they're doing it on there.
What,
but
they're singing Gino.
Crowd. Gino.
Why are they saying Gino at a Van Morrison?
I don't know.
Amazing. Okay.
But I guarantee, anywhere through this album, the first side is literally like one power thing after the other. Just, okay, now we're going to do another... And it's a lot of Stax covers and Motown covers and also everything Uptight. He does a cover of that. And the band is so tight and it's one of the best live recordings.
Do you think one of the reasons it stayed in the chart for so long is because they were like a massive live draw, weren't they? And they were in the UK. They were based in the UK. So they were playing all the time. Yeah. And then maybe that kind of created a lot... kept a lot of heat around them. On a sort of week to week. I wonder. I'm interested.
Well, if you'd seen whatever performance is on this record, if you'd seen them live, you would rush out and get that. And also, I guess, you know, people would like music to dance to.
Yeah.
It's a cracking album. Highly recommend it.
Amazing. I sort of said there's this, just beneath the chart here in the small ads, there's just a small ad that says, lyrics wanted by Music Publishing House. In London W4. And it was an advert like that, wasn't it, that Bernie Taupin responded to?
Yeah.
Which led to him obviously being paired up with Elton John.
Yeah.
So it's just interesting that just as a pop fan, you could see something like that, and that could be your sort of ticket to something unimaginable. The fact that there it is, you know.
Yes.
It's amazing.
Along with the Kenny Ball Appreciation Society.
Exactly. Something for everyone. Nine places to 34. I'm surprised to see the Four Tops live album doing so well in the album chart. Just down one to number 5 this week. Okay, because live albums, by and large, don't sound that great, but I guess it's just a simulation of a night out, right?
They do a funny version of Climb Every Mountain, and I think they introduce it. Oh, it's something like, we blew this last time we played it, and we're gonna mess it up even more tonight.
Oh, brilliant.
Or something like that.
Here's a very beautiful Broadway tune. We murdered it the first show. We're gonna bury it this one. We hope y'all like it when we get through. Climb every mountain. Thank you. Don't applaud, throw money.
Yeah, they do a strange selection of songs.
I mean, a lot of American soul bands and R&B artists, they loved sort of touring here, obviously, because the reaction they'd get. And I know there's a wonderful interview. I've got it on a sort of DVD anthology of live performances by the Four Tops. And Duke Fakir from the Four Tops is talking about just their shock when they kind of arrived in the UK, and there were like fans at the airport, and there were fans like, you know, to like a multiracial audience waiting to greet them, and they're all mixed together. And obviously, after having been at the sharp end of segregation, to sort of come to this country and to sort of see that it was just so different. And that they were respected and adored. And so he starts crying. You know, he actually literally starts crying in the middle of the interview. Oh. It's very moving. And I think, you know, the Stax tour, a lot of the musicians who are on the Stax tour, you know, had similar things to report. It was just mind-blowing to them that, you know, these really excitable kind, you know, young mixed audiences were just going out of their minds, just allowing themselves to just freak out to what they were watching. And they were treated well, you know. It was, you know. So I think they toured here a lot for that for that reason as much as anything else.
The cool ones are on. And when they're on, they go, go, go.
Baby, it was just one of those things.
What the hell is she doing?
But what goes on when a go-go girl goes off? Wow. What goes? I'll tell you what goes. She turns on the whole country. And when you're the girl that turns the whole country on, you're a star.
I feel like a...
It's okay, Cliff. It's sure not like you promised. Although I did get the feeling that last night was as much kicks for you as it was for me.
Look, it was. I just don't want it.
It's okay. It's okay.
Oh, you. Oh, baby chick, you really are zero cool. I knew you could do it, but so quick.
It's as wild as the way out world of rock and roll millionaires and go-go girls. The cool ones.
Sweet. We'll be right back. we get to the final page. It's Manfred's attitudes on his hits and films.
Right. So this is I guess it's an interview with Manfred Mann, which is what's trailed on the cover. And he seeks to clarify the point he made in a recent letter to the Times about young people taking drugs. And he says, I expected press reaction to the letter. Obviously, there wouldn't have been any reaction at all if I'd been someone other than a pop figure, a housewife perhaps. Most of the press just printed it with the tag, pop star Manfred Mann says legalise pot.
And for some reason, that was misconstrued by almost everyone.
Funny that. But that wasn't the point at all. You might have seen me on 24 Hours. I had a chance to talk about it properly. You see, my point was this. When kids start smoking pot, they think they are taking the big step, the step up from being ordinary to being extra hip, up with it in person. But really, that isn't the big step. This is just a little step, because pot, unlike alcohol and cigarette smoking, is non-addictive. Not sure about that. The really big step is what everyone else considers to be a little step. The step when someone starts taking heroin because it's a drug and so is pot. What's the difference? The difference is that heroin is addictive and a killer. That was the point of the letter. So I guess he's sort of saying that pot's a gateway drug, isn't he? Mm. And that's where you got to watch yourself. Well, I guess that happens.
Yeah. All I can think of is Brass Eye now. They say drink's a drug. It's not a drug, it's a drink.
So is he saying that you just shouldn't smoke pot? Is that what he's saying? Because of what it might lead to?
I don't know. He just sounds a bit stoned to me.
Yeah. And certainly by the time he formed Manfred Mann, that sounded like the work of a group who...
Oh, yeah.
The Manfred Mann 3, I mean.
Yes. Ha Ha said the clown, obviously, with the... Mellotron on it. But I think Manfred Mann are the first ever band to use a Mellotron on a top 40 single.
Really?
And that was from 66, yeah. Semi-detached Suburban, yeah. Mr. James.
I've been calling them Manfred Mann 3. I mean, Manfred Mann Chapter 3, to use the proper name.
It's basically just odds and ends at the bottom, isn't it? Talking about Bob Dylan's greatest hits issued in the States.
Yeah, I mean, gossip columns, and you know, the one in Disco Music echoes a lot like this as well. It's just like single lines of whatever comes into the head of whoever's sitting in the office. So it's not really, a lot of it isn't gossip as such. Some of it is, but some of it is just like, what have you got? And it's like, you can imagine like whoever's by the typewriter, you know, just people in the office just saying, I don't like that very much, or, you know, like, her hair looks stupid on the telly. And, you know, literally, that's what they get in. But a few things I did notice. Brian Auger has bought Julie Driscoll a 4-foot-long tiger cub.
Yes. I love it. It's during his continental tour.
Yes.
The Continental Isles.
Can you imagine, like, what's, you know, that's quite something, isn't it? It's like... It also explains why we haven't seen Julie Driscoll since then.
She changed it. Julie Tippett's, she became.
Yeah,
But she only had three fingers for some reason.
She was Julie Tippett's when she sang with Working Week on their second single, Storm of Light, in 1984, which I was very fond of. I was very fond of that group.
Weren't they on the Absolute Beginners?
Yeah, I think that would have been Vince Sorrell. Because they were part of the jazz dance thing that in the early to mid-80s. And... And Julie would have a huge hit like a year or two later with Wheels on Fire.
I'm not your stepping stone.
Other items of gossip, the Flies used flour bags to create an atomic cloud effect at the Roundhouse. Thanks, the Flies.
Yeah.
And that's all the gossip I've got here.
So that's Record Mirror. 1969, it was acquired by a record retailer, and it later included international R&B coverage. 1973, it became Record and Radio Mirror. And 75, it absorbed Disc magazine. 1982, it switched to a glossy pop focus magazine format.
Mm.
1987, bought out by United Newspapers. April 91, ceased publication and incorporated into Music Week as a dance music supplement. 2010, the name was purchased by Giovanni Di Stefano and relaunched online. Sadly, the site shut down in 2013 following Di Stefano's fraud conviction.
Wow.
So it's a shame, isn't it?
It is. The thing that strikes me about Record Mirror is that it changed a lot many times. So, you know, of all the music papers, it has the most changing logo of everything, like every other year. Sometimes every few weeks there's a new logo. It has a sort of a... its identity is always sort of slightly changing, but it always had a whiff of a sort of slight retail, like a trade paper sort of whiff about it, that was also at the same time trying to be a magazine that was interesting to just pop fans. So it's also a fine line it sort of trod. But I used to buy it, you know, religiously, as, you know, like in my early teens, Smash Hits and Record Mirror were my default choices. And one thing I really loved about Record Mirror at that time was that it was the only music paper, apart from Music Week, which obviously you had to have a record shop to buy that, which had the official top 75. Other papers had the top 50. NME had the NME top 50, which wasn't really proper. But Record Mirror would always publish the top 75. So you could really chart the progress of your favourite records and see what was outside the top 40. And also it had James Hamilton's amazing disco column, which, you know, he's getting a lot of love at the moment, rightly so, because it's his columns have been anthologised into a great new book. Very fond of Record Mirror. Big part of my early life. And really just I've loved going back over this episode. So thank you, Chris.
Thank you. And to read this issue of Record Mirror, the magazine's online at iamtheeggpot.com. where you'll also find an exclusive playlist of this week's top 30 singles. To support this podcast and to access bonus content, please subscribe to patreon.com/eggpod. But for now, Pete Pithides, thank you so much. It's been a joy.
Thank you. Absolute pleasure.